Thank you for acquiring this teaching series. This series is produced in cooperation with Illumination Publishers International. These audio messages are copyrighted and cannot be copied without the express permission of Illumination Publishers International. At www.ipibooks.com, you'll find other books and audio instructions from teachers around the world that are offered to help you learn and apply God's Word in new and lasting ways. At Illumination Publishers, we are committed to lighting the way to new frontiers in Christian growth. Thanks again for your desire to grow, and contact us at www.ipibooks.com if you have questions or requests.
The next person I'd like to invite up is named Ruben Villa. Ruben Villa is a member of the church here in Los Angeles, and he worked for a number of years as a security guard in a cemetery. And he has some interesting stories that he'd like to share with us now.
Good evening. It's about 8:30. And my name is Ruben V, and I've been a disciple in the L.A. church for a number of years now. I'm 40 years old, and I was actually raised just up the freeway here in Huntington Park. And let me explain to you a little bit. Let me give you some background, because I know some of you aren't from the L.A. area. Rose Hills is the biggest cemetery in the world. It's in Whittier. It's 10 square miles, and about 2 million people are buried there. And I worked there from 2001 December to about June 2005. I currently work for the Pomona Unified School District at Village Academy High School. But what happened was I actually lost a job for a municipality that's also up the freeway. I'm not going to say who it is. You might know who it is, so we'll just keep it at that. Anyway, I lost the job, and I got hired by Rose Hills in December of 2001. And I started out on the graveyard shift. My partner was, graveyard at the graveyard. Yeah, that's what I thought. And so I worked with my partner. He was a retired law enforcement. He looks like Clint Eastwood. If you saw the movie Gran Torino, this guy is to the T, this character. I mean, it's a whole different subject, but I'll touch on a little, just so you'll know the background and what's going to happen. He's exactly like that character in the movie. His lawn is just perfect. His garage is in order. He's to the T, exactly like this guy. Well, anyway, I worked with Chuck on a graveyard shift. And right off the bat, he told me, you're not going to quit on me, are you? I go, no, I mean, I'm not going to quit. I mean, I need the job. And they were paying me well. And the way the cemetery works is it's so big that it's basically like a little mini police force. We each have our own little patrol unit, an explorer, and it's got all the equipment on it, the radio. We even have an MDT on it, like computer and everything, and 24-hour shift, swing shift, graveyard shift, and you basically patrol the cemetery. Usually what we do in the daytime is break up fights and arguments. On swing shift, what we do is close the chapels, because Rose Hills has about 60 chapels. I don't know if you know that. And there's a main building that has 30 viewing rooms. So it's a lot of families, a lot of emotion. Someone passes away, the ex-wife shows up, he has a girlfriend that no one knew about. This type of thing happens all the time. But most of the time I worked there, I actually worked graveyard. And the first time I was there, Chuck took me up into the main building of Rose Hills. And he says, "Watch, Ruben, I want you to see this. And it's going to freak you out. You knock on it, and it knocks back. And the door would just knock back at you. And it was just like, and it was like really creepy, because, and he would knock again, and the knocking would get like that. And it was just like, wow, it kind of freaked me out. And he told me, are you up for it? I go, yeah, I don't have a problem with it. So I'm gonna share some of the stuff I saw there. I mean, if you want to talk to me later, because I have a lot of stories. And the first drum I'm going to talk about actually is, let me see here. Okay, I'm going to share about the Hillside Chapel. The Hillside Chapel was, let me give you a brief background. It was built in 1955. It's at Gate 14, where the Rose Hill sign is. If you pass by the 605 freeway, there's a sign there that's a Rose Hill sign. That's a whole other story, but you can ask me about that one later. That has to do more with animals, but mountain lions and stuff, but yeah, that's a whole different story. Well, anyway, back to Hillside. It was a Saturday afternoon, and me and my partner, Richard Roque, were closing the chapel. And it was about 5 o'clock, and we were actually talking about the Bible, because we were like, on the building there's a psalm. Psalm 41 is actually written on the building, and we were actually talking about that, and we were just, you know, walking and talking, and we're closing the chapel, and we're like shutting down the lights and turning off the organ and throwing away the flowers, and we're just closing the building because it was a Saturday afternoon. And they actually had a wedding that afternoon in there. And because a lot of people get married up there also. But we were getting ready to close it. As we were walking, and this was in the middle of summer. This is about maybe 5, 4 o'clock. It's not quite dusk yet, but it's late in the afternoon. For some reason, it felt like a freezing cold. Like something that just came up your back. And I'm actually feeling the shivers right now because it's like, and then all of a sudden we felt like this weight, just something just like, and we felt like actually hands just push us and knock us down. And it even scraped my knees, and I was like, it ripped my uniform pants. And it was so bizarre because we couldn't get up. And it was like really weird, and it was like me and him. And we're like trying to fight this thing. And then I started praying, and then all of a sudden it came off, but it was just this incredible amount of pressure that just knocked us down, and we couldn't get up, and it was really weird and bizarre. And then after it happened, we were just like, wow, we were just like tripping out. And me and Roque never told anybody about it there, but I told the brothers at church the next Sunday, because I used to share my stories with them. But that one was, I think, out of all of them, was the worstest one, where it was actually something that physically attacked me and just knocked me down. And it was this exhausting feeling right after it happened. It was like we just had like no energy. I remember we went and we ate, and it just sucked everything out of us. And another story I want to share about you real quick is the I'll share about the gate. Back in it was about winter 2002. And it was a heavy night when it was raining. And I don't know if you guys know how Rose Hills is designed. Workman Mill goes through the cemetery on both sides. It actually goes through the cemetery. And my job is to open up the gates every morning. So you have about maybe 12 gates that you have to open. So you start about maybe, because you have to get the gates open before the internment crew comes in. And the internment crew needs those gates open by about 4:30. Because they start digging the holes so they can bury the people the following day. And this was in the winter. So in the winter, they bury about maybe an average of 60 to 100 people a day at the cemetery. So they need these gates open to get all the backhoes in and everything, to get everything running. So Gilbert called me on the radio. He says, hey, Via, you're out there? I go, yeah, okay. You mind opening the gates for us? We're ready to go over here. So, and we got everything warmed up, and you might open the gates on the flats because we have a couple of holes we got to dig out there. Okay. So as normal routine, I would open the gates, and it was raining heavy that night. And I came up to the gate and I opened it, and I had a Ford Explorer. And you could see perfectly clear because it has that wiper in the back. And I looked in the mirror, and there's a guy in a blue suit with a red and striped tie. And he's Caucasian, he's wearing glasses, and he's like in my back mirror. So I thought, you know, this guy, maybe he came from far away, he's going to be here for a funeral later on. So I didn't really think nothing of it, and I get off the Explorer, I open the door, and I walk back, and there's no one there. And I'm like, I was looking for a car or No, there's no one there, and it's like, and it was like so weird. And then I get in my car, and I turn it on, and it's like a scene from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Just no, I'm serious. It really happened. I mean, just the radio equipment went nuts, the computer went nuts. I mean, it was just like the scene in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It was just like everything in the truck went nuts. Just the lights were on. It was just like really weird and strange. And I'm like, what just happened? And then all of a sudden it just stops. And then I turn the truck on and it just runs normal. And I put it in gear and my doors are like somebody's trying to get in the truck. I'm like, what's happening here? The passenger door on my right side, there was like they were trying to get in. And then it like whatever it was, it walked to the back and it tried to get the because it has like a hatchback and it was trying like, and I feel the truck actually moving like something's trying to lift it. And I just punched it and got out of there. And but it was really that one was kind of creepy because it's like I didn't know what to think. I didn't know what to think, and I mean I could talk all night about the stuff I saw over the years. Let me see what else I got here. I can talk about the mortuary. No, not the actual mortuary where the dead bodies are. The mortuary where they have the viewings. The mortuary, that's a whole different deal. You got to go up and count the bodies every night because they lose them. So, but that's a whole different story. I'm not going to get into that because we just had dinner. And I don't want to really say what I saw, so we'll just leave it at that. But we'll get to the mortuary. There was a guy that worked there. His name was Rudy Vieira. And he was with me, and I was working swing shift that night. And so we were going to have an easy night. We were just going to lock up the building and then just go and watch TV. Because the thing about Rose Hills, they had like this giant dish, and it had like a gazillion channels. Whatever movie you wanted to watch, they had it. They had everything. So we were just going to sit around and watch TV and not do much. Because Saturday night was actually pretty slow, and just check the gates and drive around. That was pretty much it. So the building is actually looks very similar to this. About the same, the rug and everything. And me and Rudy are walking and we're turning off stuff. And the building is empty because that part of the building is empty because it was like a whole separate building. But it's not going to be used anymore until the next morning on Sunday. But it was a Saturday night. There was no one in that building. And all of a sudden, me and Rudy are walking. We hear someone laugh at us and like make fun of us. Like, oh no, someone's, you know, either they stayed and mess around, or so we searched the building, we didn't find nothing, and we started walking again, and it laughed at us again, and it made fun of us, and it was the voice of a young girl, and it just kept laughing and laughing, and we're trying to figure out where is this coming from, and then so we decide, you know what, let's just kill the lights and we'll walk in the dark. Yeah, that was a great idea. So we're walking in the dark, and the voice started like just taunting us, making fun of us. It said some obscene words, and it was just like, and it got louder and louder. But the weird thing about this, it got really cold. And at one point, we took out our flashlights, and it just. For some reason, it just stopped. But it was very strange because the inside of the building was like freezing, like, and it wasn't the air conditioner. It was really cold. And we searched the building. We even searched the property, and we never found anything. But it was very strange because you can hear the young girl's voice. But after we turned off the lights, for some reason, it got mad at us, and it got more upset because it wasn't laughing or being joyful. It was like actually upset and angry, and it was like an angry voice yelling at us, and me and Rudy just like we just tripped out, but we never told anybody about it. And I think he told someone about it, but they didn't believe him. They thought he was just, you know, messing around or something else. Let me see, what else do I have? I got another one. Maybe I should say this one. It'll be my last one because I don't want to keep you guys up here at night and then you guys got to sleep in the Queen Mary and. You know, I don't want a jolly English ghost to show up and. But I mean, you know, then if you think about the English, you can think about Monty Python. So. But anyway, there's another chapel. It's called the Memorial Chapel, and they just had a service for an infant, and. We were walking around, and I was with one of the girls that was a mortician. She was about in her 20s. And we were just locking up, and I was in front securing the doors and closing everything. And I saw her go like this. And it's like she's reaching for something that's not there. And she goes, I felt it right here. And she says it was a baby on her chest. And I saw her go like this. And it really upset her. I mean, she was crying for a long time, and it was really, to her, for, you know, for whatever reason, it was really upsetting. But I saw her go like that, like she goes, I felt it on my chest, and that's why I grabbed it, and it was like a natural reaction. I just grabbed, and I mean, yeah, it really, she was crying for like a long time. That one was really, to me, that one was really like the most upsetting one. Because it was really, you know, it was they had a viewing for an infant, and I believe the child was maybe like a year old, but I don't know what the reasons of the death were, but it just, yeah, stuff like that just psychologically wears you out, just, but it was really, that was really bad. I have a few other ones that are more comical, but that one to me was like the most serious and the most, really bad one that I experienced. But if you guys want to talk to me more, I'll be here tonight. And if not, you can contact me on Facebook. Just look for Ruben Villa. And I got my picture from work. I'm not wearing my glasses. So this concludes my section. And thanks for listening.
All right, we're going to have one more testimonial, and then we're going to have a video, and I'll introduce that in a minute. And this is one we hadn't planned, but he showed up, and it happens to be something that happened at a hotel, at a famous haunted hotel. Jeff Arias. Thank you, Jeff.
All right. Well, those are some pretty tough acts to follow, yeah.
We're going to stop for just a couple minutes. Do the tape. While we're waiting, I have a new book that came out. Got copies over there. Just came out 2 weeks ago. Everybody should pick up a copy. My awesome, beautiful daughter, Kate's going to be selling me books. All right. Chris is ready to go.
Okay. So, anyway, yeah, I didn't know that I was going to share this, but Robert was kind enough to remind me of the story that we've told. It actually doesn't involve me as much as it involves my wife. And about 2 years ago, we were moving to San Diego, and I went online, I looked up the hotels and whatnot, and I said, oh, let's stay at the Del Coronado. That's a nice hotel. You know, so it was me and my wife and our four children. And at the time, we had a... not a newborn, but he was about 7 months old, our youngest, Jacob. So we check in, and we'd heard some little stories about ghosts and whatnot, but we didn't really take it very seriously. And so we check in our room, and that night my wife is lying on the bed, and she's nursing our son. And, you know, I'm just, like, on the computer on the other side of the room, and all of a sudden she, like, speaks, you know, like, hi, you know, and starts talking to me. And she said that she was lying there, and she couldn't speak. You know, she was having a, like, she couldn't get her voice to go, and she couldn't get it out. And she said that she was lying there, and she felt somebody come up behind her on the bed and hug her and just lie there and hug her and hold her. And at first she said it was so real she thought it was, maybe one of the kids behind her. And but she couldn't move, she couldn't speak, and it really freaked her out. So she started to speak, and she told me about it, and my first thought was, what'd you have for dinner? You know, because you know, she's really excited. And then so then we met the Carrillos later on, and Alex is telling this story, and come to find out that, yeah, Dell is haunted, and yeah, we were on the floor that this woman apparently haunts, and we were actually in the room that she's known to haunt. And I guess it was a woman who lost her child, and she died, and this is one of the things that sort of triggers this, and I guess with my wife nursing our son. So anyway, that was it. Interesting.
Now, one of the things that I think we need to ask about this subject is, all right, these are fun stories, you know, very interesting. I really appreciate Ruben's style of talking. He's pretty straightforward, you know. But really, one thing we have to ask is, okay, well, what are we going to do about this? One possibility is, and again, we're not here to tell you exactly what to do about this. One possibility is to say, oh, it's just a bunch of crazy stuff. Just ignore it. But I think, especially from Arturo and Ana Rosa's point of view, that's probably not a realistic approach to say, oh, it's just a bunch of stuff. Ignore it. Anyway, so there's a sister that I've known for quite a while, Denise McKenzie now. And basically, she has works in a ministry helping people who've had these kinds of experiences. And she's been a Christian for about 34 years. She's worked as a Christian counselor for, I think, 27 years. She worked for the church in Boston doing counseling there. And so we're going to hear her perspective. She was hoping to come. She was almost able to work it out. So instead, I asked her if she'd make a short video for us. And by the way, she's done a lot of research and is going to mention a lot of references and books. You probably won't be able to keep up. I asked her to send me some notes. We were just going back and forth, so we didn't get them. So hopefully the next day or two, I'll actually put some notes up at our website so you can kind of look up some of the things. So basically, this is a bit from a ministry perspective, perhaps, how we can help people deal with some of the issues that are raised by what we've talked about tonight. Okay, so it's going to take me a minute, and Chris is going to get me going. Dinner in Thailand.
Hi, my name is Denise McKenzie, and I'm so honored to be able to share a few things with you today, and I'm so grateful that John asked me to speak. I would love to have been with you, but the schedule sort of precluded that, but I am praying for you in your conference. I have been a Christian 33 years, in the field of psychology 25, and been in private practice about 16 years. Over the last 6 years, I've been sort of on my own learning curve involving the spiritual warfare worldview and how to help my clients in a different way than I had been. I have been learning a lot about the authority that God wants us to have as believers because of the cross and because of what Jesus did for us at the cross. And I'm certainly not by any means an expert in this area. I consider myself a beginner. I'm just beginning to really touch on the parameters of how majestic God made our mind, body, soul, spirits to be, and how intricately they all work together. But it is a very exciting thing. I really believe that he's the great counselor, so in all the testimonies that I give, it is that God gets the glory. He is the great healer. He is Jehovah Rapha. He is the one who wants to heal us of all our sins and diseases, as Psalms 103:3 says. And he's healed so many of us as we've done this work. I really want to be able to share that with you. I want to speak about some testimonies, but first I want to clarify my position on the spiritual warfare point of view and how it applies to counseling. If I were to summarize what I've learned listening to a couple people over the years, a few, actually many, listening to many broken hearts, I think the summary of what I've learned and what I've heard is that many of us fully believe that God wants to heal us, or at least we really believe that he is going to help our faith to get to that point, and that he wants to free us from our strongholds, and to live our lives to the full, as it says in John 10:10. Because that's why he came. He came to set the captive free. He came to undo the works of the devil. He has already rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son that he loves, as it says in Colossians. But many Christians don't live this way. And I think that the second thing I realize is that many of us don't realize that we need to co-partner with him to experience this victory, to sort of seal the deal. It's not that we, by our works, we're saved, of course, at all. It's only by the cross we're saved. But we need to see ourselves as agents, not victims. As Colossians says, we're seated in the heavenlies with him. And we're fighting the battle along with him. We're not helplessly sitting by, waiting for God to do everything. As James 4:7 clearly sums it up, submit yourselves then to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Notice who should be doing the fleeing here. It's not us. And notice which comes first. That, as Neil Anderson says in his book, In the Bondage Breaker, which is an excellent resource, by the way, that I highly recommend, if we submit ourselves to God but don't resist the devil, then our lives lack power and authority. However, if we try to resist the devil on our own power without first submitting to God, then we are in for a dogfight. So it is that balance that we need to find. And sometimes I don't think we really have a spiritual warfare worldview in our generation. I think sometimes the biggest thing we fight over is who's going to get the remote. My favorite movie is Joan of Arc. I love it. Here she is, riding out in the battlefield on a white horse, leading an army of men, risking her life at 17 years old because she believed God told her to do that. And I really believe God has told us to fight the battle. He's given us the principles, many, many scriptures on this. Ephesians 6, the armor that we're supposed to wear. We are not to be passive, sitting by, letting the devil toss us to and fro. He's already secured the victory for us in advance, and he's given us the authority that Christ won at the cross over sin and death, and he's equipped us. And he wants us to fight these battles because, not that he needs us to fight, but that it will help our characters and help us grow in faith. And in my own work as a Christian counselor, I have had to pray for people, but the basic way that all the spiritual warfare worldviews shows up in my counseling is that in moments of trauma, Satan, what Satan does is he gets us to believe lies, make vows and agreements. And we do this either consciously or subconsciously, sometimes before we're converted or sometimes after. And in that way, he gains an access, a degree, a foothold. I don't believe we can be possessed as Christians. That word possession is mistranslated. It actually means oppression, which is a degree of access, like it says in Ephesians 4, don't let the sun go down in your anger, lest you give the enemy a foothold. So the enemy can get a foothold, but he cannot possess us. And the fruit that has been born using these techniques to pray away and take out the enemy with the lies and vows and agreements that we've made has far exceeded any other counseling method I've used. I've seen people become permanently free of and experience deliverance from symptoms, both emotional, physical, and psychological. And in some cases, in light years, in terms of difference of time, sooner than the conventional methods. I have a client that I worked with that achieved more deliverance and more success, more symptom freedom from her symptoms in 1.5 years than the people that I work with in supervision, other therapists, have seen with their clients in 15 years. So it's very fruitful. And I always say, you know, the evidence of a technique or of an approach should always bear the fruit of it. So I just want to say from experience that I've seen a lot of fruit from this. So the errors we can, in summary, the errors we can get into is either to sensationalize this issue and give Satan too much bandwidth, or actually avoid it completely. One way we avoid it, we become powerless, is we get fearful. We don't need to mess with these things. They're better left alone. By the way, do not fear is commanded by Jesus many times for a reason in the Bible, because fear and getting us to believe lies are two of the main tools that the enemy uses since the cross has defeated much of his authority. authority. If you're in fear when it comes to the enemy, then you can know that you're being deceived. Another way that we become powerless is we become passive. We'll leave it all up to God. We'll remain uninvolved. We can take the historical approach, believe that it doesn't apply to us today. We can take the medical approach, which is one I believed for many years. We know that stuff like this is better handled by doctors and psychiatrists. We can also take the pristine approach. It's just too raw and archaic for me. God wouldn't want us to get our hands that dirty, would he? Or we can take the scientific approach. We can't see it, we can't measure it, therefore it's not there. How can I pray about it? Well, obviously Satan is there. Jesus talks about him more than he talks about a lot of things. So, but on the other hand, we can err by taking the power approach, which is the side that the New Age movement takes, that believing that we are God and that all we think, believe, and command and will should manifest, leaving no room for God to reign over us as the supreme authority in the universe. So both sides are dangerous equally. And there is a middle ground. In the middle, there's a balanced approach which we can feel confident. As believers, we can be submitted to the Lordship of Jesus Christ, the truth of his word, and be equipped to fight the battle. The sin, as Clinton Arnold says in his book, sin comes through us in three ways: the world, the flesh, and the sin, and Satan. So sin comes to us all commonly in these three ways. And oftentimes we have learned to really work with the temptations of sin through, as they come through the world, as they come through the flesh, as they come through those things, but not through Satan. We have learned to be equipped and fight the battle that way. It's kind of like going into being a SEAL and going into a mission, but only getting a third of the SEAL training. We're going to be taken out. You know, we really need to learn this aspect of our spiritual warfare. These are the same battles Jesus fought in the desert. It's a common battleground. So it's really unbiblical and unsanctioned to think that deliverance is exorcism or things like that, finding a demon under every rock. That is unbalanced. And instead, we need to look at spiritual warfare as a common part of our walk every day as a believer. In fact, it was a central part of the gospel message. You know, go out, preach the word, heal the sick, drive out demons. So it wasn't peripheral, it was central. And there is a real need for that. Now, when in our Bible study group, we went over the bondage breaker, and we did it sort of as a pilot study, men and women, and then we had people give testimonies as to what they got out of going through that book. So that's a great place to start. It has 7 steps to freedom in the back of the book, and it's really a great place to start. And one of the things they said is, after I pray, I feel a lifting now of freedom. I don't feel stuck anymore. I don't have to be afraid of Satan. And nobody who is a Christian should ever be afraid of the enemy. We have the authority. When we submit to God, we can resist Satan. Another person said, I've totally changed the way I pray. I pray with spiritual authority now. Satan told me at the beginning of this group, the bondage breaker, that it wouldn't work for me, and I believed him. Some people joke that the devil made them do something, like they have no responsibility. God taught me how to pray and overcome the fear of Satan. Another person said, I know I can make it through my Christian life now, which was I wasn't sure about before, due to Satan's lies. Satan is like germs. We know they're there, and even though we can't see them, we still have to learn to wash our hands when we need to, because if we don't, the germ can take us down. But we don't need to get too focused on it all. So in terms of my clients, my friends and my family, in the scope of time, I don't have much time to go into all this, but when I moved back to Denver, I trained under Sarah Thiessen, who invented a technique called Slotna. She's actually in the Church of Christ, and it's called, you can go to her website and read more about it. It's ChristianMindBody.com. But these tools, this technique is like finding the x-ray, but Jesus is the healer. The x-ray shows us what needs to be healed, but Jesus is the one who takes it out through the tools of simple prayer and confession. Again, not exorcism, but simple prayers and confession. And simply learning our authority to revoke the lies, the vows, and the agreements that we've given over to the enemy. These all need to be renounced in prayer. Once they are, then I see amazing healing. Like I said, a couple books, The Bondage Breaker by Neil Anderson, Victory Over Darkness by Neil Anderson, I Give You Authority by Charles Craft, and three crucial questions about spiritual warfare by Clinton Arnold. Also with Sarah Thiessen and her techniques, you can actually take these trainings. You don't have to be a therapist. So that's a good thing too. So these lies, vows, and agreements show up in the subconscious or the conscious, often in the subconscious. So the tools help you get to what they are specifically. There was a person I worked with, I'm just going to call her Christine. Well, she came into my office, and she'd been hearing voices for 12 years and had been under psychotherapeutic medication for that long, and nothing had helped. She was a disciple. She was at the end of a rope, and she told me, if this doesn't help, I don't know if I can live the rest of my life like this. And I said to her, I said, what are the voices telling you? She said, not to go to church, not to read my Bible, not to pray. And I said, is there any possibility that you think this voice could be from the enemy? She stood up, glared at me, and said, what? How could it be that simple? And stomped out of my office. So I was a little puzzled by that response. But she called me later in the week, and she said, Denise, I'm driving to church, and the voices are getting really loud. I said, can you pull over somewhere? And she said, sure. So she pulled her car over. I said, can you follow after me in a prayer? And she said, sure. So I said, and I led her in this prayer, God, if these voices are not from you, I command them to leave now in the name and authority of Jesus. I bind them to the cross. I forbid them to ever come back. In Jesus' name, amen. She prayed that prayer, and she came back the next week, and her voices were gone. And I worked with her for a year and a half, and her voices never came back. Not only that, in the course of a year and a half, she was an amazing client, but in the course of a year and a half, she had come to me with PTSD, major depression, all sorts of things like that. She had was taking medications, waking up every hour throughout the night, not able to sleep in her bed, not able to have hope about her future, not desiring ever to get married, not able to have feelings, not able to cry, not able, she had to miss a day of work a week. She woke up every hour. She had to sit in the back of the church in case someone would hurt her. She had difficulty praying and feeling close to God. And she had difficulty reading her Bible. When she left after a year and a half, after doing, really renouncing all these lies and vows and agreements and casting out the spirits that goes along with it, because in the process of renouncing lies, vows, and agreements, we cast out the spirits that are associated with those vows, lies, and agreements in prayer. That's similar to what I just had her pray. And after a year and a half, she could bring her needs and feelings and preferences into her relationship. She felt closer to people. She was closer to her coworkers. She wasn't missing work anymore. She wasn't waking up in the middle of the night. She was sleeping through the night. She wasn't hearing voices. She could sleep in her own bed, which she couldn't before. She was off all medications. She was no longer missing work. She was having increased energy, better concentration. She was more active. She was able to feel all her feelings. She was able to see herself getting married and having children, which she couldn't before. She was less guarded and more relaxed. She didn't have to sit in the back of the church. She was motivated to get closer to God and work on issues. She was praying. She was reading her Bible. There were some physical issues that cleared up, and she was happy. She felt like, I can live life now. Well, anyway, that's one. And there are others, but just in summary, what is a vow? A vow is something like, I'll never trust a man again. For a woman I worked with, it was sexually abused. She had no man approach her. She was in a school that was largely male, and very pretty girl. No one ever approached her. After she revoked this vow, she had an old friend of hers. She'd been in grade school, come up and ask her to be his girlfriend, and he wasn't even planning on it that night. And he said, something about you has changed. I don't know what it is. And she was always being approached by guys after that. Another vow, I won't ever succeed at that. I'll fail at everything. He renounced that, and he started succeeding. I knew a woman who vowed she would eat whatever she wanted, whenever she wanted, because her father was so controlling that he had forbidden her to do that. She came to me 100 pounds overweight. She renounced the vow, plus several others that she had made. And over 1.5 years of Christian mind body, she lost that 100 pounds, kept it off, and unlike previous attempts, she had no compulsion to eat anymore. Another vow is, I'll never let anybody see the real me. fever down to that and lost 100 pounds as well, and she was able to get close again to her family and friends. A client, when he was a little boy, his dad beat him up for not cleaning up his room well enough when he was sick. So there's the trauma. And it's always in moments of trauma that the enemy speaks to us. And he believed the lie that I have to work really hard to be accepted by others. And he made the vow, I'm going to work really hard in life so people won't reject me. And he didn't even remember making this vow. He came in because he'd been through 3 marriages and he was a workaholic working 90 hours a week. Well, after the tools revealed that this was the root of why he was working 90 hours a week, he renounced that in a simple prayer, and he came back to the next session and said, I don't even have a compulsion to work past 30 hours a week. He said, I really believe now I can have a marriage that will work. Another man lifted a phobia of 40 years in one session, a phobia of height. And he was able to go up on a height of an elevator and show us and wave down from the railing at us. And he was never able to go within 30 feet of a guardrail. So those are some examples. Lies can be, nobody will ever love me. Agreements are a little harder to discuss, so I won't for time. But as we've all known, we've all felt stuck at different areas in our lives. In my own life, one of my favorite stories is my husband, who was healed of 4 decades of insomnia that plagued him and gave him symptoms of ADHD, which he didn't have. He would wake up in the middle of the night a lot, have a difficulty falling asleep more than an hour, and this was happening every night almost for 4 decades. He cleared it after doing the steps in the bondage breaker, doing the Christian mind body, and getting to some lies and vows agreements that he needed to break. And he cast the spirits out that were attached to this agreement. He's slept so well since that sometimes I'm jealous of him, and I'm a pretty good sleeper. And so those are some of the testimonies. So again, some of the things that we can all use and focus in on with our friends and ourselves is confession, meditation, affirmations. I give people homework, scriptures that are stretching, positive, to replace the lies they believe for 30, 40 years. They say that 10 times a day out loud. They write it 10 times a day. And then I also encourage them to do prayers that invite God to show us the vows and lies and agreements that we've made. And he will. He'll expose those. And there isn't like one prayer. There's not a formula. Just to really renounce it is the most important thing. Also, you can ask people, what are the lies that you're believing that's causing the distress in your life? Have you made a vow? Have you confessed and renounced these beliefs, these lies and these vows? Have you affirmed the truth to replace those lies and vows? So, those are some of the things I use. And thank you for the time.
Okay, well, that's going to end our program for tonight. Hopefully you found it interesting and helpful. And Doug's going to be doing a talk. I've been looking forward to this for almost a year on Christianity, the paranormal, a biblical perspective. And then John Clayton, not all of you know John Clayton. For Doug and I, he is like, other than Jesus, he's kind of the hero of heroes. We're so, poor John, but. So we're so blessed to have him. He's going to be sharing. And then Foster and Copeland, I believe, together is going to be sharing a class on perhaps a psychological perspective that might help us to perhaps see how that might explain a certain amount of the things that we refer to as the paranormal. And then a class by me. Okay? And then we'll have a forum. So that's the schedule tomorrow. Done for the night.